From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. You are you, or at least a close approximation thereof. This is stuff they don't want you to know. You've heard of spell books before, probably, right? If this is a surprise to you, then buckle your seatbelt, because this is going to be probably one of your favorite episodes of our show. So, several of us are fans of horror movies. If you are a fan of this show, you probably have a higher statistical likelihood of enjoying horror movies. I'm a big fan of them. And if you enjoy horror movies, then you're also familiar with that old trope, the cursed book, right? What's the most famous example of the cursed book?
Well, the one that comes to mind for me is H.P. Lovecraft's Necronomicon, which is that ancient cursed book, which is
more of a tome.
I guess, yeah, it's a tome. It's clearly a work of fiction because it is written by H.P. Lovecraft. But numerous people have attempted to create a real Necronomicon.
Right. This tome of dark eldritch magic, according to Lovecraft and the Cthulhu mythos, it was composed by and I'm quoting here, a half-crazed Arab named Abdul al-Hazred. We should note at this point that amongst many other things, Lovecraft was cartoonishly racist.
We've covered this, people.
Right. We've covered this. And what's interesting is Lovecraft himself maintained the book was entirely fictitious. Mm-hmm. And what we found, and this will tie into some stuff later in the show, is that despite the fact that whenever he was asked about it by friends, family, or journalists, right, and despite the fact that he would always say, this is fictional, not only did I make it up, but I didn't make up all of it, I just made up some excerpts for my short stories. Despite that, it got to a point of popularity where more and more people became fans of his cosmic horror genre and then started writing their own Necronomicons, as Matt said. And this takes a path from fiction to fandom to reality take place in more recent things, like Slenderman started out as pure fiction, purely knowledge fiction that gained such notoriety that ultimately it had real world consequences.
Well, the Necronomicon has that same effect where it's like introduced and then reused and sort of like adjusted and adapted to different times, different personalities, and it almost takes on a life of its own, like Slenderman, where even though the original creator was like, yeah, this is definitely fake, the more you start to see it in different incarnations, the more the mind tends to go to, well, maybe it's not fake, you know?
Right, yeah. And that's the moral of the Necronomicon story, in a way, is just because something isn't real, whoosh, whoosh, to take your air quote move, doesn't mean that it is not dangerous. On a lighter note, there are many other spell books in fiction. Of course, we'll all recall, since we all have impeccable taste in films, Disney's Hocus Pocus.
Book, darling, come to mommy. Yes.
Book. And let's not forget the more malevolent yet equally hilarious Necronomicon Ex Mortis from the Evil Dead films.
Hey, wait a minute. Everything's cool. I said the word. I did. No.
Or even that that creepy book with the face from the Care Bears movie.
Yeah.
Anyone?
Yeah.
You're too late. Too late. The last spell is cast.
No.
Really?
No, I can't even handle that one.
Well, that, yeah. Oh, I was about to say, I thought you were saying you were not familiar, because that is the stuff of nightmares, my friend.
It possesses that kid.
It possesses this little kid who's like the magician's assistant, makes him do things, and the Care Bears have to come down and do their stare.
Care Bears stare.
The Care Bears stare.
Remember the Care Bears? Let's not get too far off. It is a Necronomicon of sorts, a grimoire of sorts, because if in the way it's depicted in the film, it is a big, thick tome that he finds in a long-forgotten, dusty magician's chest, and it's got all of these kind of esoteric scrawls and different symbols all through it, and it, you know, spawns this weird, green, bald, kind of androgynous face that you know, makes him do things.
It's straight up possessed by a demon.
And what that, you know, that reminds me, this is a separate talk about censorship, which ties in later too. The cartoons of yesteryear, I think, were a little better because they were less sanitized.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? A demonic possession film marketed towards children.
Where the main heroes are fuzzy teddy bears with different symbols on their tummies that can shoot out rainbow magic energy.
Completely nude.
What did it even do, by the way? What did the stare do? Did it just fill you with goodness?
It was like the heart ring in Captain Planet, except bears.
Yeah, it was overwhelming love and compassion.
Yeah.
That emanates from their tummy.
It was a very aggressive form of nonviolence because they were shooting people, technically.
Now, this is not to say that a grimoire is inherently evil.
Yeah. Additionally, when we talk about just the fictional stuff, we also have another side, which would be that there are a lot of out and out hoaxes. Mm-hmm. Someone wrote something and pretended they discovered some ancient source of knowledge hidden or occulted from the public eye. Sorry, let me not say that in such a dumb voice. Regular occulted.
Was that an edit or was that you?
No, that was just me not wanting to sound so NPR about it.
Fair enough. Now, I've got a question for you. Would you consider – we've talked about the Voynich manuscript, and I know that's going to come up later in the episode. But since we don't really know, does something to be considered a hoax have to have a hoaxer? Do you have to know who did it in order for it to be considered a hoax?
No. That's an excellent question. For something to be considered a hoax, there must be something about it that is marketed or propagated that is untrue. So if – you anonymously wrote something and 300 years later, Matt's descendants find it and they just don't know you wrote it, it doesn't make it a hoax. With the Voynich manuscript, they can't read it. But if you wrote something that actually happened, like 300 years ago, this happened, we don't know who you are, it doesn't make it a hoax. If Matt wrote something in 1998 and then waited in some master plan to give it to us and say, hey, I found this in a grave and it's 400 years old, that would definitely be a hoax.
But we're also sort of in the realm of, like, you know, if I write a spell and tell you this is a legit spell and you can't do it, you can't recreate what I'm telling you it should be able to do, is that a hoax, or are you just not any good at doing magic?
That's a great question. We raised that in one of our earlier episodes on the occult too, because there's a fuzzy line here with a hoax. For people who don't believe in magic, any book of magic written is essentially disingenuous, right? But there are quite a few people, maybe not as often now, but in the span of human history, who believe that they were simply the instrument for some supernatural or otherworldly being that was writing through them. Is it a hoax when the creators absolutely believe in it? You know, that's almost a matter of perspective. But even let's go one further. Are there any real grimoires, meaning are there any books of magic created by people who genuinely believed they were creating a how-to manual on, you know, the so-called occulted arts?
Shall we have some facts then?
Yes, there are numerous examples of historical spellbooks. Today, these are popularly known as what this episode is about, grimoires in the West. But, you know, what we're going to explore here is primarily stuff that's occurring in the Western world. It's crucial to note, though, that these things exist throughout the globe, throughout the planet, in the East, in the North, in the South, all of the cardinal directions you will find these. However, we would have to make up our whole, like a whole different show to cover all of them.
Right. It wouldn't be just one episode to cover all the cultures across the globe that have their own varied traditions and rituals and incantations that other people might call magic and these people might just call, you know, their day-to-day life.
A Tuesday.
Yeah, perfect. So, like you said, Matt, we're sticking with Western spellbooks, grimoires. First question, what's with the name? That's not a name you hear every day. Scholars are not completely sure about the etymology of this word, but the most popular belief is that the term grimoire comes from Latin via Old French, grimaire, which originally just described this is kind of funny. It originally just described any book written in Latin.
Hey, there you go.
Is there any connection to the word grammar, perhaps? Like language?
There must be. Yeah, there must be with the root. And back in the day, something as mundane as a how-to manual on, avoiding the plague by Lord Noel Brown, or Well Digging for Dummies by Duke Matt Von Frederick.
Trademark.
It would also be a grimoire back then. And then eventually, in France, people started just using the term grimoire to mean pretty much any book that was difficult to understand, anything that was a pain in the keister to read. And then the big shift to where this goes from just being a word for difficult book to this book has magic powers came in the 19th century in Britain, in England, in the publication of a book called The Magus in 1801. The British had a real profound interest in all occult matters at the time. You know, this is the age when people are getting into the concept of using scientific principles to investigate things that have once been thought to be purely the realm of spirituality and magic. So they're interested in this, and through this book, the term grimoire became firmly cemented in English as a word that meant specifically books of magic in general. And since that point, of course, we talked about the hoaxes that emerged, and a lot of them ballooned after this book came out. Typically, stories take the same strokes. Contemporary writer, let's see, since this is an example of a bad person, and I kind of picked on you guys by giving you cool books earlier, let's say some slightly disingenuous person, we'll call him Admiral Bolin or whatever, makes up a pseudonym like Antonio Ventana della Rabina, who is the supposed author of the Grand Grimoire, also known as the Red Dragon. So this charlatan of an admiral then implies that this text is ancient and it's handed down in secret for centuries, millennia, or if we want to get super weird with it, a secret pre-existing civilization that rose and fell before the biblical flood.
And then there's a bullet point here on our notes that's just four question marks. So that's where we're at.
Yeah. And the next step after that is profit, notoriety, et cetera. Oh, also, by the way, I never get to use this word. The word for things that existed before the biblical flood, prelapsarian.
Ugh.
I know, it's not the sexiest word, but, you know, it never comes up. So obviously this proliferation of these fraudulent texts has given the whole enterprise of occult books a bad rap. But we also have to remember there's a context in which so many of these texts were made.
Yeah, not only were books in general much, much rarer and more expensive. They were a commodity. I mean, you had to be, you know, a bit of a fancy pants to afford to have books and to have access to good quality books and books of high academic rigor.
Heck, to read.
Of course. Yeah, duh. I'm putting the cart before the horse there. But research as we understand it today was in its infancy or pretty much did not exist. You did not have the resources to research in the way that we just have an embarrassment of riches via the internet. You know, there's that Encarta encyclopedia CD-ROM. Those are great. I'm kidding. But
they were great. That was a game changer.
It was a game changer. But when you look at it now, it feels the way, you know, it must have felt to go from having a book to having a library, you know?
That's a good point. And there was also this implicit degree of trust between authors and readers, right? Like, after all, if we're living in the 1300s and we're some of the people who see a book that happens not to be a religious text like the Bible, then holy smokes, of course it's got to be true. Why would somebody spend years handwriting this thing if it was gobbledygook.
Or just for fun.
Just for fun. Why would somebody do an elaborate troll like that?
Well, and I guess that's a big part of why when like things like pamphlets and tracts became widely distributed, that was a great way to misinform the populace because those were cheap to make. You could very easily kind of fit some propaganda in there and have it circulate and have that same mentality of, oh, it's printed on paper, therefore it must be the truth.
Can you imagine how those guys would have felt, those ladies and gentlemen, if they saw Facebook posts? I mean, that's pamphlet times a million. So this means that, of course, while grimoires get a hard time, books of magic were not the only inaccurate things out there by any means. But we do know that before the British called spellbooks grimoires, before the French read Latin, before even the age of the Roman Empire, magic in some form existed around the world, or magical practices. Earliest precursors to books of magic are these incantations found on clay tablets in Mesopotamia. And that's the earliest we found so far.
Well, would you guys mind if we pause for a quick break before we got into the details of that?
Sounds good.
Cool.
And we're back. We're back in 2016, but we're talking about ancient Mesopotamia. Let's fast
forward. It's 2017, bro.
Oh, it's 2017.
It's weird.
What?
It is 2017.
Where's my flying car?
Yeah. Where is your flying car?
It's in my suitcase.
But the suitcase also flies. We should have thought of that.
Oh, jeez. That's a big suitcase.
All right. I got the year wrong. It is 2017. But back before it was even 2016, like way before, the Greeks believed the first people to compile books of magic were in the Persian culture, where a Persian tribe known as, wait for it,
the Magi. Yeah.
Yeah. It's basically like magic without the C.
Hey, that is a cool word and term. I don't, for some reason, I love that.
I've actually heard it pronounced Magi quite a lot as well.
The Magi?
Like there's a story of the gift of the Magi. I've heard it pronounced that way.
Oh, I thought it was Magi.
Well, no, I think both are acceptable. Listeners, call me out. Tell me I'm full.
And there
of
was
it.
Some translation stuff too.
Oh,
because
totally.
In earlier text, it used to be spelled M-A-J-I, you know? So, folks, we're talking about the same ones, the famous wise men of the East, perhaps best known today in our neck of the woods for their cameo during Christ's birth in the Christian Bible.
I grew up in a classical music family, and one of the sort of operas, kind of an operetta, I suppose, that my mother was quite fond of was, it's called Amahl and the Night Visitors. And it's about, you know it?
My dad played Amahl for a long time.
Sure. It's a thing. Churches do it all the time. But the wise men are really central characters in it because they hang out a lot and they all have their own personalities. And one of them has this box that he carries around that's full of all these amazing little trinkets.
Yeah.
And like one of them are like a bunch of them are these precious stones that he considers magical.
Yeah.
And he describes them, and it's like moonstone will make you sleep, and like lapis lazuli, and like all these different ones that have these different properties that are all clearly
charms.
You know what I mean? Charms, yeah. But he, you know, ascribed very specific effects to these stones just by placing them near you. And Amahl, the main character, is a boy who can't walk and has to use a crutch. And the wise man is trying, you know, attempts to even cure him, or implies that he could cure him using some of these trinkets. But I'm just saying, it's interesting.
These charms, yeah. You know? And that is because originally, before we see the rise of the book, we're still like talking about before the age of the book, these spells would be inscribed on amulets and things like that. So the Greeks believed that the first magician, magi, to compile occult works into a single large text or collection was a Persian associate of King Xerxes. Remember from 300? I'm kidding.
Is he the one with all the nipple rings?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I think that's not entirely an accurate film. But there was a magician, the story goes, named Austhenes. And during Xerxes' failed war with Greece around 480 BCE, this magician allegedly scattered the seeds of what would become much of the world's modern, in the time of the Greeks' understanding, magical thinking. Also, in this story, the Magi learned their arts, their occult arts, from Zoroaster. So this is a tie-in with the earlier religion of Zoroastrianism.
I was going to say, yeah. So I've heard that mentioned in several places on the net, that those guys were Zoroastrian.
You're on the net?
On the net.
You're on the net. That's nothing but a bunch of pamphlets.
Oh, crap. Well, it was the web then.
That's my favorite Sandra Bullock film.
You know, I rewatched Speed and it doesn't hold up.
Lies!
So today, as we said, they're thought to be grimoires, like an umbrella term for different types of magical knowledge. And it can include everything from, you know, how to create charms, a la the Magi, how to perform spells, practice divination, which is a big one, summon supernatural entities, angels, spirits, demons, dominoes.
We actually have a grimoire that we have to use every single time we podcast with Ben, because he just, you know, we have to, you know, summon him. He has to materialize from his interdimensional, what do you call it, lair?
Allegedly.
Yeah. Just so you guys know, in three separate grimoire, I found spells to ward against cattle witching and diabolical mischief and cattle, like how to ward against it. It's pretty awesome.
It was a big problem.
Yeah.
It was a big problem. Oh, we want to thank everybody who wrote listener mail to us about that.
You know what occurred to me? Like, how come supernatural entities and extraterrestrial entities alike can't quit messing with the damn cattle?
Well,
that's a great question. Snatching babies, stealing cattle. And there's a troubling and compelling argument about how closely older descriptions of the fae or fairy folk can jibe, like almost a one-on-one correlation with stories about UFOs. But you know what, man? Maybe it's like, you know how you follow the money in politics? Maybe we follow the cattle in UFO. I'm just going to leave this where it
just
is.
Really fast, I want to say how important the cattle were to peoples of the times when a lot of this were written.
Oh, sure.
And so if anything's going wrong, if you're not getting milk correctly, or if there's blood in the milk, or, you know, whatever small ailment the cow has, that's going to be the biggest problem that your whole, you know, group mm-hmm. is experiencing at that time.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's easy for some people who have not lived in an agricultural environment to, you know, we can poke fun at this, and it's all good natured, but it's sort of the idea of, let's say if your family owns cattle, right? They're probably pretty well to do in many ways, but think of it like your father or your mother would then be the same thing as, like, they own a small car lot. Every single one of those is super important. Mm. And if something goes wrong, then it's food out of your mouth.
Yeah, exactly. Except in this case, instead of cars, you're literally drinking and, like, consuming the byproduct, you know?
It's true.
So it's like, true. So yeah, I got to live.
and so these books were like compendiums, almanacs, reference works of all this other stuff that existed, oral traditions. Sometimes the books themselves were believed to be imbued with magic powers, not just the stuff you would read or do from the manuals or the grimoire, but the physical object. And there's a special note here that I think is important. We're lucky to have listeners of all spiritual stripes or no spiritual stripes on this show. And like that preacher character in Poltergeist said, all are welcome. All are welcome.
Bless your heart.
Bless your heart. Exactly.
And then he said, oh!
Spoiler alert.
Well, that's a good film. But so you might be hearing this talk of magical books either on this episode or another episode and wonder, you know, hey, how do spiritual reference works fit into, you know, holy text and stuff?
Why, I was wondering that, Ben.
Great. Well, no time like the present. Technically, these would not be considered grimoires. In fact, many people would consider the correlation to be offensive, right? Mm-hmm. In the current day, they're definitely not considered that, but many do contain either explorations of the occult or mentions of the occult. You know, there are characters that are fortune tellers, soothsayers, practicers of witchcraft. And some of these books were often believed to have physical magical properties themselves. Just the text on the page imbued it with some sort of power. And this belief exists in a more subdued form today. This is why, for example, you can hear religious excerpts being read during exorcisms in Catholicism. And that's just one example. You can check out our exorcism episode for more info.
And despite all of these hoaxes that we've talked about, we do know that there are a couple, let's call them true, with quotes, grimoires. In his book, Grimoires, A History of Magical Books, author Owen Davies names several. So we're going to go through a couple of these.
Yeah, and they're from all across the spectrum of religions as well. Jewish, Christian, Islamic traditions, all of them.
Yeah, well, yes. And all of these were, they were influenced by this Babylonian myth that is ancient, super ancient. And the origin of these magic books were dated to the age before the Great Flood, as Ben said.
Prelapsarian.
Ugh. Okay.
It's not that bad of a word.
As long
makes me think of prolapse.
I was going to say, as long as it's not prolapsarian.
I never thought about that. Oh, man.
I'm a prolapsarian.
I just lost this word now. I guess it's better that I get it. This explains why everybody.
A prolapse is a scientific word.
I know, but I know
it's true. There's no reason to edit that.
I don't even want to say it on the mic.
You didn't say it, I did.
It's too late. Yes, well, my misunderstanding of before the flood, which is the prelapsarian is still a great word, you guys. The idea here is that the ancient roots of what would become magic in the West, which would be Babylonian, Mesopotamian, Egyptian, interacting with Grecian mythology. This stuff becomes sort of a primordial ooze, you know, a soil from which these other things grow. And while some Hebrew and Samaritan texts ascribed writings to the first man, Adam, in late antiquity in the medieval period, Enoch, who in Arabic was known as Idris, was more generally believed to be the inventor of books.
Just so overall.
Yeah. So we're so far back in time now that we're looking at spiritual and religious traditions as well as stuff history tells us. But this right now is purely the stories from these belief systems. So in the tradition, Enoch is the creator, essentially, of the first book, but also the first magic. The first book is essentially magic. Mm-hmm. Another tradition relates, here's another worldly author, how the angel Raziel communicated to Noah a secret book containing the art of astrology, which was then written on a sapphire, like we were talking, like writing on emeralds and precious jewels, that Noah kept in a golden chest that he brought with him on the ark. Subsequently, this was inherited by his son Shem, and there's a surviving tract on astrology called the Treatise of Shem, that dates back to the late first century BCE.
Wow.
This means that, these are two early contenders for what could be considered a kind of grimoire. The purported books of Enoch contained astronomical, astrological, and angelic lore, and we know that versions of these were circulating during the time of Jesus Christ. So in another medieval account, and again, these are all medieval accounts. So this is still that period of time where people were just believing almost anything they read as long as it did not directly contradict their religious beliefs.
Sure.
So without getting too deep into biblical chronology, the argument here would be the earliest works on the occult sciences were those studied by Enoch, but the first book of conjuration and magic is associated with Noah and his sons Shem and Ham. And in many ways, this veers into conjecture, of course. Often that's sadly par for the course in some degree when we're dealing with ancient history. But there's another one that's a little bit further, a little bit closer to us in time.
Okay.
Whatever year we're in. I can't believe I forgot that it was 2017.
I didn't mean to call you out.
No, someone should. At least I was really close.
You were so close.
That's one of my New Year's resolutions, is to call people out more this year.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Like the fascinating.
Yep.
I remember that.
I certainly remember.
I invite the same, gentlemen and listeners.
I am no gentleman, though. Owen Davies cites the – I didn't mean that to come off so ominous. Owen Davies cites another one, the Key of Solomon, which you may have heard of if you have an interest in grimoire. It pops up in fiction all the time too. I think it even pops up in video games now. No, I can't recall which one. You guys probably know better than I would. Clavicula Solomonis. is the official name. Key of Solomon, sort of the Anglified street name. It was the earliest known written versions. There are multiple versions of a lot of these kind of books. Dates back to the 15th century, somewhere in the 1400s, written in Greek. Davies has a great quote for us about this.
There is no definitive version of the clavicule, but along with conjurations to command and control the angels of darkness, manuscripts usually contained rituals and symbols for personal rather than spiritual well-being, such as to provoke love, punish enemies, become invisible, and deal with thieves.
And also unlock any door. I found that to be interesting.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And I like that deal with thieves.
Don't you find these all to be really practical, timely kind of things, mm-hmm. you know?
They're like life pro tips.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's nothing there in that list that's super, super abstract. You know, abstraction would be more like the great work of alchemy.
There's nothing like about summoning the eldritch horrors that will then turn your mind to jelly, you know?
That's true.
That should be a thing.
There are remedies for gout that I'm looking at right here.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a big problem.
I have one that I actually found in a work that we'll talk about in a little bit. But would you like to hear a spell?
Yes,
gentlemen.
Let's do some spells.
Okay. So this one is as described in the passage we read a second ago. It's got these little symbols that it's not quite clear what their origins are, but they kind of look almost like Hebrew a little bit. They're kind of like, what do you think, Ben? What are these? Do those jump out as
they look maybe, some older Arabic,
maybe
perhaps?
Older Arabic. They're kind of a cursive-y, very fluid, stroke where the characters are connected together. They're not like very definitive individual characters. They're sort of like a big flowy central line and then different, sort of filigreed little bits along the path. But here's one. To know of treasure hidden in the earth. Mm. And this comes from a book called The Discovery of Witchcraft, which was written by a man named Reginald Scott, who was from Kent in England and was a gentleman. And it was published in 1584. We'll go into this work a little bit more. It's a perfect place to hear a spell. This one. To know of treasure hidden in the earth. On a piece of paper, write the following characters on a Saturday in the hour of the rising moon and lay it where you think treasure might be hidden. If there's treasure on that spot, the paper will burn. And then it gives the characters.
Whoa.
Interesting.
And just to give proper credit, this comes from a blog post by a gentleman named Jason Mankey, who has a book called The Witch's Book of Shadows that you can seek out, which sort of talks about different historical grimoires, including the Key of Solomon and some others that we'll discuss, including this one. But yeah, all very seemingly practical. Like I want some treasure. I want to know. You know, it's sort of a pre-metal detector. You know.
Yeah, that's a great point. And so these were practical things, and this means that the first collection of spells probably dates back into antiquity. It probably just didn't happen to be in a book form yet before the rise of the book. But the spell, like Noel just read, very, very practical instructions in that age, right? And so, of course, you want to accumulate all of those and have them in one place. And the concept of magic itself predates writing because it goes back to oral tradition and stuff. So another big question is, if these sorts of things have been around since the dawn of recorded history, why aren't there more examples? One of the answers to that question is also surprisingly pragmatic and practical and grounded in the real world.
Censorship.
Boo.
Mm-hmm. Yep. By the early years of Christianity, magic scrolls and books were in wide circulation. But to the church, magic fundamentally smacked of paganism, a competitor. No matter whether someone professed to be a Christian, if they were still engaging in pagan practices, you know, like some sort of divination using the entrails of animals or something, that was still paganism to them.
Is the Bible a grimoire?
The Bible is not a grimoire.
No.
The Bible is the Bible contains stuff about occult information and occult characters practicing magic show up, but it doesn't tell people how to do it. And it's interesting because there is an evolution in the early days of Christianity where we see the line between what was perceived of as magic and what was perceived as holy practices or whatever became blurred depending on who you asked.
And I wonder if the use of the word occult as a term of abuse, you know, occult meaning hidden, is part of that or was proliferated by Christianity and Catholicism, because if the Bible doesn't tell you how to do the tricks, it just kind of tells you should follow and leave that to the people that know how, that know what's up in terms of like who can commune with, you know, the Holy Spirit. I mean, obviously in certain, beyond Catholicism, you could do it yourself. That was a big part of, you know, the Reformation and all that. But I like the idea of Christianity being anti-occultism because they already have their own book and they already have their own experts and their own practitioners of that are higher level, and they don't want the plebs getting their fingers in that stuff.
Right. Thou shalt not intercede. Right. But I just made that up and used thou shalt, but the argument is absolutely sound. What you're saying, Noel, is that is an interesting juxtaposition there, a position for them to take. And it reminds me, before we go on, did you guys ever hear that Prince Philip quote about religion? It drove the more conspiratorial minded people quite mad. And it was a quote where he talks about the revealed religions. And a lot of people thought that to mean there was a mystery or an occult religion of which he and some other elite cabal was part or were part. But the word, apparently the way the word is being used, a revealed religion is something that has its beliefs and its value system set down in a book or a text, according to the official story. But to the church, at the time, early days of the church, they saw magical works as impediments to the socio-political dominance of their belief system, which meant they sought to actively destroy works that ran counter to its purpose, which at that time was to convert people, right? As many as possible, to protect adherents of their belief system from the prejudice and discrimination of other groups. And, you know, other – like this is – basically what religions were having to do to survive, especially if there was a state-sponsored religion that had a lot of power.
And you got to get that tithe money in. I mean, how can you build, you know, entire complexes, churches, cities without that tithe money?
So they would be destroying books, and books were very powerful. Books are still powerful today. The book is not going away for a long time. And of course, just a bit of foreshadowing here, there were apparently a few exceptions to their rules of burning and destroying unholy books, and you will read ad nauseum so many stories about certain unspeakably vile works hidden in the bowels of the Vatican. Point of order, though, although Christianity gets picked on for book burning pretty often nowadays, and although there were a lot of books burned in a lot of religions' names, the early church was not the originator – early Christian church, I should say – it was not the originator of this idea. Way before they got started, pagan Roman authorities were also suppressing any literature that threatened state control of religion, especially – like we've named all these powers, right? How to sneak into places, how to find treasure, how to summon angels and demons. But the thing that – civilizations were most frightened by in these magical workings, it wasn't cattle witching. It wasn't necromancy. It was divination. It was the idea that if – even if it was a totally fictional prophecy, if enough people believed in it, it would destabilize the state. It would destabilize the military. It would, you know, topple the House of Cards or the Column of Cards, the Parthenon of Cards.
This is something I wanted to bring up really fast. I was watching all of these YouTube videos with this gentleman named Tarl Warwick. That's at least what he calls himself. The YouTube channel is Styx Hexenhammer 666. And he I don't know exactly what he is besides an editor of books and a translator and also a thinker and an occultist, I guess.
You say his name is Tor?
Tarl, T-A-R-L. I believe that's at least what he calls himself. But one of his main arguments when discussing the occult, he has a whole video series on the occult, is that if a belief is held by enough people and strongly enough, then it is what separates that from reality and fiction, right? If the belief is strong enough. So one of these tomes that would be considered a grimoire, if enough people believe that it's real, is it not real in some way? If there are enough people actually chanting out the words that are inside of it, or, you know, believing that it's true. And so I can imagine that the Romans were terrified that if one person gave this divine prophecy, then enough people believed it, then perhaps they're going to try and fulfill it no matter what.
Yeah, there's a mimetic or viral quality to belief. So if Noel receives a prophecy and enough people believe it and follow him, depending on what the prophecy is, it could just be self-fulfilling.
Yeah. Man, I got prophecies for days. Ask me about something.
All right. Yeah. Hey, Noel, what's going to be, you know how like the guitar is often considered the main instrument of a lot of modern music today? Is it going to have a replacement? And if so, what would that be?
The keytar. It's like a guitar, but it's also a keyboard.
That's pretty good.
It's going to make a comeback.
That just checks out.
Yeah. Okay. I have one really fast.
Sure.
When will 21 Savage retire and become whatever his next thing is?
I don't know who that is.
All right. It's good enough for me.
I think sometimes we see only partially, you know.
Through a glass darkly.
There we go. Yeah. See, he read my mind. In 186 BCE.
Oh, I do have a prophecy.
Oh, you do?
We need to take a break.
And so it shall be fulfilled. And so if it was fulfilled.
That's crazy, right? When you said that, that happened.
And I didn't even say those things. It just came out.
I saw your eyes roll back. Are you cool? You're bleeding a little out of your ear.
I'll be all right.
All right. Well,
here's a Q-tip.
Thanks.
While you're queuing up, which is our new slang for Q-tips, while you're queuing up, let's further this with some examples of times that non-Christians or non-monotheistic religions were like burning books, or non-Abrahamic religions, we should say. In 186 BCE, for example, the Senate rounded up and burned books, only books on soothsaying.
Okay.
The medicinal stuff was fine. Over a century and a half later, 2,000 books, also on divination, were burned on the orders of Emperor Augustus. But it wasn't just for magical books either. It was just books that people disagreed with, like religious and philosophical works, didn't do much better. In 181 BCE, somebody found a buried chest of books that were supposedly the work of Pythagoras. And then the Senate said, oh, wow, what treasure, burn it.
Oh,
I mean, these guys were burning books left and right. Religious works, of course, were also burned by opponents on all sides. If we were living back then and Matt and Noel and I each had different religions, like one of our main missions would be to destroy the other people's stuff.
Yeah, as much as possible.
Unfortunately. And then try to convert each other. Which reminds me of that story. I don't know if you ever heard it. Just real quick, and listeners, please fill this in if you're more familiar with this story than I am. There were three patients at an asylum, a mental health facility, who were each convinced they were Jesus Christ. And one of the staff members, one of the doctors there, said, you know what? Let's put these guys in a room and see what happens. And then they thought they would come to blows or go crazy, you know, have some sort of break. But instead they came back to find them apparently like pleasantly chatting, just about everyday stuff. And then one-on-one interviews apparently revealed that they had each come to the conclusion that the other two guys were crazy.
This is, I've heard of this. It's got a weird name. It's like the three Christs of, and then you insert the name and it's like, it starts with a Y.
The three Christs of Ypsilanti.
Wait, is that it?
It's a silent Y. Yeah, I mean, it definitely starts with a Y. There's a book and a film, according to the Google.
Thank you. Good save, Noel. So do check that out because it shows just some of the intricacies of the human mind and perspective. But all this burning, all this censorship led to an unfortunate situation wherein modern experts may know that a certain text existed. We may find multiple references to it in other documents and other historical works, but all copies of it were either lost to history or consigned to the tragic ashes of a fire somewhere. And this means that many grimoires are fakes or half-truths or destroyed in the thousands of years since humanity invented books, found we enjoyed burning them, and the very beginning of what we happen to call the year 2017. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm thankful that for now, people have not found a way to burn podcasts.
Yeah, we should have been making books out of something less flammable early on, I think.
It's easy to say that now. So to sum it all up, the TLDR, Davies writes that the magic of the first millennium as we know it from surviving written text, which is a heck of a caveat now, as we know, was primarily a mix of Greek, Egyptian, Babylonian, and Jewish influences. Medieval grimoires reflect this, but new traditions developed as scholars, theologians, and I would also insert charlatans, reconceptualized and reconstructed, sometimes falsely, the cultures, philosophies, and beliefs of the ancient world. And at this point... we have to give the bummer disclaimer.
No.
Bummer announcement. At this point, as we're recording this, and we looked, absolutely no one ever has provided accepted, reproducible proof that any spell or incantation in any true grimoire works, at least so far as we could find. And most of the claims regarding a successful ritual are either very old and anecdotal, or they're backed up by the same single group of spiritual adherents.
Yeah.
So, like, there's not anybody saying
that group did it successfully over there, that one.
Right. And there's not someone saying, well, let's ship the book off to, you know, Dunwich and try it there and get the same results.
That anecdotal thing is something we've found in a couple different podcasts and episodes where we really wanted to find evidence. It reminds me of the ghosts episodes where we are looking so hard to find something that we could say this is proof that this exists. But everything that you read is the story from one person or two people, you know, a small group that performed a ritual and it was successful.
And it's one of these things where should it be that hard to find the evidence of a single person with all of these different books, all of these different accounts? If it was a thing, shouldn't it be a little easier to find a video, a YouTube video of someone successfully performing a spell or a ritual?
And there are questions because there are also people who will say, well, I've successfully performed a ritual and it had results that are either not easily comprehended measurable. Or depicted yeah. or measurable. Yeah, exactly. And so one of the things
that came up a lot in the alchemy episode.
Yes, right. Is it weaponized psychology, I believe was the phrase. And it's true that some of the things that you can do to yourself and others simply through psychological manipulation come very close to what we would think of as acts of magic, you know, 800 years ago or so. We do know that while there might not be any proof, so far as we know, and we would love to see proof, if you feel you have some, please send it to us. This is not – we're not going to blow up the spot if you ask us not to tell anybody. We just want to know. While there isn't any proof so far that we know of people actually successfully, reproducibly – that's the important part – casting spells from a book, there are mysterious books in the world, many more than you might think. And we have some examples of grimoires that are still either unsolved or have numerous questions, or that we're convinced if they we're convinced that there's stuff about them we have yet to fully understand.
And we have a bunch of examples here
in no particular order.
The Book of Soyga, which was allegedly given to John Dee on March 10th of 1552.
The Queen's favorite alchemist.
By an angel.
What?
Yes, it was then lost for 500 years following the death of Mr. Dee. And then apparently two copies remain in England. That is where they exist. And they're written in this code that is yet to be solved. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty strange, especially considering a book was lost for 500 years. Another is the Prodigiorum ac Ostentorum Chronicon, or Chronicle of Portents and Prophecies. This is interesting because it was written in 1557, thereabouts, by a guy named Conrad Lycosthenes. This book is a reference work of sorts, and it contains, here's the thing, it contains documented events, like we know historically these happened, stuff that you can't fake, like Halley's Comet at the correct time, like floods, disasters. But in between these different world events that are accurate, it also contains descriptions of sea monsters and UFOs and things that today are more relegated to the realm of fringe theories.
Next, we have the one I mentioned earlier, which upon further discussion and you know, observation, I don't know if it necessarily be classified as a grimoire or not, but I think it's worth mentioning because of what it contains. It is The Discovery of Witchcraft, written by a Sir Reginald Scott. He's not officially a sir to my knowledge, but I think it's got a nice ring to it, who was a Kentish gentleman, a gentleman from Kent in England. And he was attempting to debunk witchcraft and place the blame for the execution of witches on, you know, the Catholic Church, a lot of these witch scares and witch trials, and wanted to kind of paint these many of these women who were killed as complete and total victims, and, you know, meant this not this book to be a very damning portrayal of the way the church, the Catholic Church, behaved. But it ended up becoming, I think, possibly counter to Scott's intended purpose, this collection of various bits of lore and even different spells, one of which we read earlier about finding the treasure, became widely read and considered a resource on the subject. So I'm wondering, Ben, you said that resource books and historical collections of this kind of esoterica, this kind of witchcraft spells and such wouldn't necessarily be considered a grimoire, but isn't it also in how you choose to use it? Is it all about the intent?
That's because, a really good question.
I don't know. I'm asking. I think this is worth a mention, but it's up for debate. The jury's still out as to whether or not this would actually be considered a grimoire.
Well,
so listeners, if you have any thoughts on that, please let us know.
I think it would if it has a collection of lore spells, even if he didn't intend it to. There's this this conversation that we've been having off air for a long time about, you know, who owns a piece of art after it's created, whether it's a sculpture, a song, or, you know, a story or a book.
It did have a spin to it, like I said, a markedly anti-Catholic spin and ultimately anti-witchcraft. I think it was a little bit sympathetic in a way, but kind of like thought it was frivolous, not dangerous at all, just sort of like a passing fancy, sort of, if you will.
I see.
And meant to sort of neuter it.
Well, that would be effective because the ideas about The ideas about witchcraft in Europe at the time were largely held and propagated by people who saw themselves as opponents of the practice, and a lot of innocent people died. So if this book got through to someone, if Sir Reginald Scott's book did prevent someone from being executed in some incredibly torturous way, then I think it was a good deed. However, I could easily see the unfortunate path that appears to have happened, where someone said, here, I found a grimoire too. I don't care what he says about these spells. I'm going to find some treasure, you know? And I think you make a beautiful point about the use of these things, right? Like, is a can of gas and a lighter a ticket to a warm fire at night? Or is it a ticket to burn down a building, you know?
Ooh, it is all things.
And if the belief here is that this magic actually works, then in a way, people would see these books as weapons, even if somebody made one that said, clearly I'm showing you that this is all malarkey and you should stop hurting people for silly reasons. But then also, there's some stuff, probably one of some of the biggest legends. We've talked about some, like there's the Book of Shadows that we touch upon in our video stuff. There's one that got me, that I'd really like to hear from the listeners about. It's called the Grand Grimoire, or the Red Dragon. And this is sort of, this is one of the white whales of the Grimoire world. It was allegedly written in 1520, and it was penned by a guy named Honorius of Thebes during a particularly nasty bout of demonic possession.
Oh, yeah.
And so,
been there.
And so, yeah. And so you have. And so apparently the spells within it work. It was owned, the legend goes, it's owned by the Roman Catholic Church and it's unavailable to the public. It contains the only working rituals to summon Satan or other demonic forces such as Pazuzu. Think like Pazuzu from The Exorcist.
Pazuzu!
And Baal.
And Baal.
All right.
And then also ways to corrupt the Pope over time.
Oh, wow.
So if all that's true, why didn't anyone destroy it, especially with his predilection for burning books?
Off the subject a little bit, are you guys stoked about the young Pope? Because I'm really excited about it.
I've seen the trailer.
I watched the first 20 minutes of the first episode last night. I love it, but Diana was falling asleep. So I said, we're going to table it till tonight.
Put a pin in it.
Yeah.
Well, listeners, let us know what you're thinking about the young Pope. I'm excited about it.
The first shot.
Yeah.
On the entire thing.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
No.
Oh, you haven't seen it?
No.
Okay. All right.
The first thing you
see. I'm trying to figure it out, trying to see where they're taking me. But again, I've only seen the first 24 minutes or so, but the first shot.
You know, I know they can be controversial throughout history, but I've never had an unpleasant conversation with a Pope, on my end at least.
Have you divined
so
conversations with popes?
Here's the kicker. Here's why they can't destroy the book.
Oh, yeah.
Because apparently it can't burn.
Is there any way we can have that happen and then talk about the young Pope? Because it was building it up so well. I was waiting for Ben to say it can't burn and then go to the young Pope. Is that possible?
I thought like the young Pope worked.
That's okay.
I think it's fine. I think it's okay.
Yeah. Because we're clearly like having fun with each
other. Okay. Cool.
Beep. Now I know that's a lot to take in, folks. And I want to let people know I recently have been sending some correspondence to the Vatican to see, you know, if there's any sand to this story, because I at this point couldn't find an official yes or no over whether they own a book like this. There are copies or purported copies that you can buy because apparently it's popular in some other circles, especially in Vodun related circles. But those aren't the only mysterious books. There's also some that I would consider the we don't know books, like the Ruhongsi Codex, donated to the Hungarian Academy of Sciences in the early 19th century. Not only do we not know what it's about because it's written in, like the Soyga Chronicles, an uncracked code, we also don't know where it comes from. It just sort of showed up with an alphabet all its own. Some people believe it is a hoax, but so far, at the time of the recording, no one has proven that to be the case.
And then, of course, there's the Voynich manuscript. We've talked about this in an older video. This has come up in numerous episodes just as a creepy, cool, one of those topics that you could bring up at any dinner conversation and you'll be the toast of the dinner.
The table.
Because it's really cool.
Well, it doesn't have any inherently, like, occultish. It doesn't have spells. It's all these amazing, gorgeous, frankly, illustrations of things that just frankly don't exist.
Right.
Well, but they might.
Like plants that aren't real, you know, in a very naturalistic,
as though it were a medical illustration of some sort, or like you said, something from Darwin's journals, perhaps, like very much looks to be observational illustrations, which is what makes it so darn cool.
It's named after the book dealer Wilfried Voynich, who acquired the book in 1912, and it's been dated to sometime around the 1400s, maybe as recently as 1438, and it appears to be, as you were saying, part pharmacopoeia, illustrations of plants and herbs, but also part alchemy, part just treatise on the cosmos, part of an encyclopedia for a world that doesn't exist. And it appears that this is just scratching the surface of one part of the world's evolution with magic, and just a few of those books. There's so many more, but it appears that whether or not you believe in magic yourself, there really is stuff they don't want you to know about grimoires. We'll never know exactly how many magical texts were lost to purges of ancient empires, religious zealots, looters, and plunderers. And it's tantalizing to know that some of these are mentioned in other texts and we will never encounter them. Because the people who didn't want you to know this numbered in the hundreds of thousands, perhaps the millions, and they had executed this conspiracy thousands of years before we were twinkles in our grandparents' eyes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you think there's real magical knowledge that's hidden out there that's gone? It's just lost because these texts are gone? I feel like there's got to be some kind of knowledge, even if it's just herbal, some herbalism stuff, what certain plants can cure, you know?
Right.
Like just medicinal. Through trial and error over time.
I mean, that I'm sure that happens now. Pharmaceutical companies have sent people into, you know, into very rural areas of the Amazon to research plants, the efficacy of plants treating disease. If we're just spitballing, I guess it's also possible that an ancient civilization could have documented the orbit of a comet or something that is so far out and comes so rarely.
Totally.
That we wouldn't be aware of it, possibly.
We just saw not this previous Monday.
Where there was 48 hours notice.
Yes. We're like, oh, there's a giant asteroid that we are just seeing for the first time.
And then, you know, I think it's completely possible that there are books that are hidden and they were written by people who believed very much in what they were writing. And then I'm sure that there are suppressed works. Whether those are waiting to be found or whether they were destroyed or whether they actually can do something, whether it's possible for us to summon something. I don't know.
I think we should try.
You think we should try?
I kind of want to try. We should get Wolven in here again. What? And Damien. Yeah. Let's get Damien. Let's get him to, let's do it.
Damien, the creepy kid from The Omen?
Yes. He and then our friend Damien, we'll get him to come in too.
That'd be a powerhouse duo.
Yeah. Can you go double Damien? Is that like...
Yeah.
It's not going to be like when two people in the same crew wear the same hat?
I don't know.
Two Damiens don't make a Shamian.
Shamian. A Damie Wright? Okay. All right. Well... We do hope that you enjoy this episode. We're interested to hear what you think because there's so much information about grimoires and there's such a, I'll say it, fascinating evolution here that we're going to continue exploring this off the air and may have some updates for you or may have some updates from you for your fellow listeners. If you would like to read more about the evolution of grimoires, boy, have we got a book for you. Check out Grimoires, A History of Magical Books by Owen Davies.
And if you like this kind of stuff, go to grimoire.org. There is just a place where you can look up different grimoires. And they're listed out through a timeline as well with the purported written dates and throughout the centuries. It's good stuff.
Do we have time for a little
shout out corners? Skadoosh.
Excellent. Yes, thank you, Noel. Our first shout out corner goes to Devin W.
He gets his own entire corner.
Oh yeah, he gets a part of the corner. Scoot over, Devin. Sorry.
Nobody puts Devin in a corner.
Yeah. Actually, I really like this. We're in one corner because there are four corners, obviously. And then there are three shout outs and each one is in a different corner.
So it's more of a shout out room.
Yeah.
All right. Well, while we are working ourselves. Out, okay, we're going to get some pen and paper and figure this out, or just some blood and papyrus. Devin W. writes in and says, love your podcast. However, I was listening to you guys' recent show on the hemp car. When you guys were going through listener mail, you seemed to be under the impression that Vladimir Putin was the head of the KGB at some point. I didn't think that to be true. I did a little looking up and found, in fact, he was not. He left the service as lieutenant colonel. It makes sense since this is a narrative driven by the media lately. Anyways, just wanted to correct the record. Thanks for a great podcast. Devin, thank you even more for a great correction. These are very important to us. Devin, you are correct. This was on me because the truth of the matter is that on July 25th, 1998, Yeltsin appointed Putin as the director of the FSB, the Federal Security Service, which is the successor to the Cold War KGB. Devin, thank you even more for writing. This one was on me, folks. It is correct. Vladimir Putin was never the head of the KGB. He was appointed the director of the FSB, the successor to the KGB, on July 25th, 1998 by Yeltsin. So he was in charge of the successor to that. He was in charge of the FSB intelligence service.
And was a high-ranking official in the KGB.
Yes.
This one comes from Josh at Shivers Smash on Twitter. At Conspiracy Stuff Noel, there are reports that the Smashing Pumpkins are legitimately getting back together for a tour. You are a wizard. No, sir, not a wizard. A seer. A prophet.
A sayer of sooth.
A sooth. Sayer. Slayer. Yeah, no, that's cool. I hope maybe it'll keep Billy Corgan from saying dumb stuff in the press and getting sued over wrestling and going on Alex Jones. That'd be cool. Play some music, Billy Corgan. I'd be down with that. What? Why are you guys eyeballing me? I have issues. I've got beef. The guy sort of, you know, ruined my childhood by like being such a blowhard.
And that's not the only tweet we got regarding Smashing Pumpkins.
I have feelings about Billy Corgan. I'm sorry.
Are you okay?
I was just a huge fan when I was a kid. I thought he was such a sensitive lad. Felt like he really summed up my teenage angst.
I liked Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness.
Yeah. I mean, those, you know, doing the 10 albums that affected your teenage years that's been making the rounds lately, three of them were Pumpkins albums for me. So, you know, why you got to do that to a kid, Billy Corgan? But anyway, another one. We had Philo Cult tweet at us. You guys asked the Smashing Pumpkins to get back together, and they did. You know, it was just an inkling. It was an inkling. That's all I can say.
Well, maybe there's something redemptive about it. Maybe the story of Noel Brown and the Smashing Pumpkins has a better ending.
Maybe so. Billy Corgan, I still love you, man. It's cool. I have opinions, too.
And the last shout-out goes to the Ben Randall at In the Weeds WBR, who says, yo, I don't even smoke weed, but I would totally smoke some sweet kitten whisper. I think that is hilarious.
Yeah.
I think anyone would, really.
Well, you can always count on Ben's. They're good people.
That's right.
If I'm being honest, kitten whisper sounds like the name for a much harder drug than weed. I'm just putting that out there.
That's true. It's like if you see a really mean-looking, rough person and they have a very strangely soft nickname, you need to be frightened of them.
Yeah, steer clear.
Yeah, if you see a 7'2" guy with visible face scars named Sprinkles, run.
Whoa, yeah. Here's the other thing. What does a sweet kitten whisper like sound like? Are you going to put something in there?
I got nothing, man. No, I'm not going to put anything in there. That's not a sound that the human voice can make, okay? that is beyond our meager powers in this room right now.
I was going to try.
It would be unfair to kitten whispers.
I'm going to do – this is what a sweet kitten whisper sounds like.
All right,
like,
go right? for it. I don't know why that makes me uncomfortable.
Gives me the ASMR tingles.
Yeah, maybe that's
it. That's what I hear, man. It's like it's a meow. It's a sweet little kitten meow, but it's also –
should we pop a sweet kitten meowsy down the old dusty trail?
Yeah, I think it's time for us to be meowed.
Yep. And
be
with that.
Meowed.
And with
Scotty.
That,
all right.
If you have any suggestions or comments or you want to shout out any of that stuff, you can find us on Facebook where we're Conspiracy Stuff.
You want to put me in my place?
Yes.
You know, give me what for?
If you want to give Noel what for, hit us up on Twitter. We are also Conspiracy Stuff there. If you want to, I don't know, what do you do on Instagram?
If you look at pictures.
If you want to look at pictures?
If you want to see some behind-the-scenes stuff that we do here that may not make it to the air for one reason or another, you can follow us on Instagram. We are Conspiracy Stuff Show. If you want to check out our exorcism podcasts, some of our earlier works while you're on the internet, you can find every single podcast we've ever done at our website, stufftheydontwantyouknow.com. And hey, if you haven't heard of that Care Bear movie and you're already online, I bet you can find it on YouTube.
It's true. And hey, if none of that whispers your kitten, give us an email. Drop it to us at conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.